broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line, whatever time it is, wherever you are. Most of us woke up to the news this morning of an event that has not happened in almost 600 years, and that is the resignation of the current Bishop of Rome. And I was not overly surprised by that, to be perfectly honest with you. Ratzinger has said in the past that he believes the Pope can resign, and it just strikes me as being consistent with his understanding of things, that once you get to the point at 85 years of age where you just can't do this anymore, then you stop doing it. But that hasn't happened. I've always thought that the way the Mormons do it is just silly. I don't think this is how Joseph Smith intended it to be. If he'd even thought that far down the road, I don't know that I can give him that much credit. But the idea of, you know, being led by a doddering old man, which is what you absolutely require is going to happen 95% of the time, because that's what happens to us, when you have someone in place until the end of their life, just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And you know, there's a lot of speculation. There's, you know, does he have a terrible disease that he may not even make it till the 28th of February? And you know, that's a possibility, I suppose. Other people are speculating that some terrible scandals going on. I was like, you don't know anything about that. The fact of the matter is, he's resigned. And as I read the statement here, what struck me, I mean, we're talking about an unbiblical office here, a position that, unfortunately, in our world, because, you know, again, it's a situation of, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so, you know, those Roman Catholics, you know, they say good things about abortion and stand against homosexuality, and they're fighting the HHS mandate and, you know, all the warm, fuzzy, ecumenical feelings that people get going. It's pretty easy to just start going, okay, so the Pope guy wears a funny hat, and I don't like people bowing down and kissing your ring, but it's really not that big of a deal, is it? And yet, as I was listening to Catholic radio on the way in, they're talking about our Papa, the Holy Father, the Vicar of Christ, and all the rest of this stuff. And even in reading his statement about the convoking of the conclave to elect his successor and all the rest of that stuff, though I wonder, what's he going to do? I mean, what do you do when you're the retired pope, you know? That's not something that no one's ever had to think about for, like, again, six centuries. But even in his statement, he says, "And now let us entrust the Holy Church to the care of our supreme pastor, our Lord Jesus Christ, and implore his Holy Mother Mary, so that she may assist the Cardinal Fathers with her maternal solicitude in electing a new Supreme Pontiff." That's just, you know, let's just not worry about the Holy Spirit here. You know, he can't quite pull it off on his own. We need Mary to get involved in selecting the next leader of the Church. Of course, Mary on Earth wasn't involved in that. But anyways, you know, you got to remember, we're dealing with a system here that has been fundamentally compromised at its core. And that comes out very clearly in this. But all this is going to do is it's going to mean we're going to hear I don't think it's going to be as bad as it was in 2005 with John Paul II and, you know, the dying, you know, took a couple days type thing. And every Catholic apologist on the planet got his 10 minutes of fame on Fox News, you know. People who just, you know, don't have a serious bone in their body, you know, selling pilgrimages to Jerusalem, but they're on Fox News doing their thing, and it's just like, I don't think it's going to be quite as bad this time, because you don't, you know, he's only been Pope since 2005, not nearly as quote-unquote beloved as John Paul II. He's not dead. So you don't have all the mourning and the immediate moves for canonization and all that kind of stuff going on. But I'm sure we'll still see some of these guys coming on and talking about the constant faith of the church in 2,000 years and and the fact of the matter is that's just anyone who knows history goes, really? Seriously? Honestly? Anyway, so that is what is going on with that. I don't have much to comment on beyond that. You know, I heard the news just like everybody else. It's an unbiblical office. It's, you know, but we've debated this subject over and over and over and over again. And I don't think there's anything to be gained by some of the folks that are running around today, you know, doing their John Knox impersonations either, you know. It's great that the Antichrist has been struck down. And, you know, that, and yeah, it's, that doesn't really accomplish much either. But it would be nice if it was a opportunity to point out to folks the unbiblical nature of the papacy, if most folks had ever taken any time to actually think about it. Saying, well, sir, the Bible has a pope. Well, that's true, but what you know, how about a positive argument that that Peter, you know, the successors of Peter and all the rest of that stuff. But anyways, that's a whole other issue. Now, what I needed to get to today, and what I'm going to get to today, is to try to finish off the 2011 Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society article by N.T. Wright. I did see an interesting email exchange between N.T. Wright and someone who listened to our dialogue. And a lot of folks focused in properly on the fact that, you know, the big question is, and it remains the big question, when you stand before God, what is going to be your final plea? What is that real basis? That, and I understand that N.T. Wright is trying to stay within the categories that he himself has established by his study and all the rest of that stuff. But look, I question the validity of a theological formulation that causes you to stutter and stammer at the graveside or at the bedside. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that that's the best place to have in-depth theological conversation, but when it comes down to, you know, the pastoral work, what good is theology if it doesn't allow you to actually do that, is the question. So I want to get back to this, but Jeff Downs forwarded me a link, and I don't thank Jeff often enough for the fact he's a tremendous apologetic resource, remains that way. A good guy. He's one of our blog guys. There's a lot of good blog guys we've got up there. They don't get to write as much as I wish that they could, but we've got some fine folks up there. Jeff sent me a link to an article that discusses, on the basis of certain of N.T. Wright's books, his views on Christology, and says no one ever talks about N.T. Wright's view of Christology. Well, I started looking at it. I was troubled, and the funny thing was, we did actually video the my side, obviously, of the dialogue with N.T. Wright on Unbelievable. And I'm pretty certain that Justin gave us permission. I think we could even post that sound file on our website if we wanted to. But be that as it may, from the camera angle behind me, there would be something that's normally not there. It's still there. I haven't moved it. But I put a music stand behind me because I was just running out of places around me to put books and stuff. And on the music stand behind me is N.T. Wright's commentary in the Interpreter's Bible series on the Book of Romans. And so I'm reading some of these quotes that have been put together in this article. And if I interpret them within my tradition, they sound really bad. But I'm starting to realize you've really got to try to listen to N.T. Wright in his context to really know what he's saying. And so I think, okay, let's turn around and let's look at what he says in his commentary on Romans. On, and if you're looking at Romans and you want to look at what someone says on the deity of Christ in the Book of Romans, where are you going to go? Well, there's one primary text in the book of Romans. There are a couple others where the name Yahweh, for example, in Romans 10. But there's one primary Christological title passage in Romans. And that's Romans 9:5. And so I spin around and I turn to Romans 9:5 and I read Bishop Wright's comments on Romans 9:5. And what do I discover? Is he believes that it is a Christological passage that is specifically teaching the deity of Christ. Okay. So, with rather strong arguments, far more than you'd expect from a liberal. So, once again, years ago, you all have heard, well, maybe you haven't, but years ago, and I have mentioned this to people when they ask questions, you know, about N.T. Wright. And I have said more than once, I've said, N.T. Wright giveth, and N.T. Wright taketh away. In other words, you know, and the example that I used is his debate with Marcus Borg. I'm not sure. I don't remember if John Dominic Crossan was involved in it. I don't think he was. He might have been. I don't remember. But, again, ironically, from 8 years ago, I remember exactly where I was on the Sun Valley Parkway. I could get within 1 mile, one way or the other, because it's a rather nondescript area out there. So, but I could get you within 1 mile, one way or the other, of where I was on the Sun Valley Parkway when N.T. Wright said something. I'm like, wow, I'm going to have to remember that because it's really helpful to us. And what it was is he was talking about, we don't know what the order of the Gospels were. We theorize about Matthew, Mark, and Luke and the relationship between them and stuff like that, but we don't know. It's just all a bunch of theories. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly right. And then like 5 minutes later, he's arguing Lazarus didn't die. Lazarus really didn't die because that messes up his idea of what resurrection is. Lazarus didn't really die. And there's Marcus Borg going, but Lord, he stinketh. You know, so you got the ultra liberal Marcus Borg going, but Lord, he stinketh. And, you know, so within 5 minutes, N.T. Wright giveth, N.T. Wright taketh away. That's just the way it is. And part of it is because I and a lot of other people tend to interpret every statement he makes within our paradigm rather than within his. And I'm very sensitive to that because, you know what? What's the majority argument against me when it comes to Reformed theology? Taking what I've said and not interpreting within the context of what I've said, but within the context of an Arminian worldview, and it makes it sound really silly. So if I'm going to be consistent, then I've got to bend over backwards and try to be fair and listen to the man in his own context, and that's what I'm trying to do. So here's what I'm going to do. Only spent 3 days on this, and the response even to just going through this Jets article has been very interesting. There's been a lot of people very clearly, who have been troubled by what N.T. Wright has said, attracted by some things he says, repulsed by other things he says. I think that's pretty much all of our experience. And have just sort of put him off the side and said, man, I wish somebody would simplify this stuff and explain this stuff. Well, I'm not looking at stopping my studies of anything else, but... I would be willing to work into my continued reading of Sahih Muslim and Malik's Muwatta and all that other stuff that I spend hours listening to on the bike and then bring them into Dividing Lines. I would be willing to work into that the necessary N.T. Wright books that would hopefully allow me to at least interact with... Well, in fact, one of the things that was said... Let me see if I've still got it here. On the phone... where did I have that at? Oh, yeah. One of the... N.T. Wright, when he responded to this fellow, said, may I ask you one quick question? Do you base your Christian belief on Scripture or on tradition? Boy, you know what? One of the things that freaks people out is being on is for us to be on the receiving end of that challenge. Because we are so used to giving it to somebody else, let's face it, what freaks us out is it freaks us out that someone's doing that to us. No question about it. And one practical question, listen to this. Is your car driven by fuel or by your foot on the pedal? I think I know what he means by that. The final statement of justification is based upon the life lived. That's what he's trying to explain there. I can guarantee you he's trying to explain that there. We'll get more to that in the article here. And one specific question relating to your heaven question, have you read Surprised by Hope? Well, again, here I am. I don't know how many times. We had a Mormon debate in channel. When was that? Saturday night. It wasn't really a debate. It was just a discussion with a Mormon that came in, and it was interesting. But one of the things that was somewhat frustrating is right at the beginning, I said, have you read Letters to a Mormon Elder, or is a Mormon my brother? And I've written two books on Mormonism, spent a lot of time doing that, a lot of research, and there have been a lot of Mormons who have said, you obviously spent a lot of time, research, et cetera, et cetera. And the guy goes, no. All right, so there's an automatic disadvantage that he has and an automatic disadvantage for me, because I'm going to have to be repeating stuff that if he had read my books, I wouldn't have to be repeating. Okay? Well, same thing in this situation. I can't talk about N.T. Wright if I haven't read N.T. Wright when N.T. Wright has written books on the subject that we're talking about. So, Surprised by Hope is a book on resurrection and heaven. If I want to know what he thinks about how you get to heaven and what the nature of the resurrection is and what the basis for standing before God is, and he's written a book on it, then what do I need to do? I need to read the book, basically. And I have ways of doing that that allows me to proverbially kill two birds with one stone. So what I have done is if you go to the ministry resource list, now, unfortunately, what I didn't do was put a link to the ministry resource list on the blog. All you got to do is search for ministry resource list on the blog, and it'll come up. And the link's always the same. I'll try to do it after the program. But if you'll go to the ministry resource list, it's just an Amazon gift list is what it is. But we started this, I don't know how many years ago. It has been a huge blessing to me specifically, but to the ministry as a whole in providing me with resources. If you go to the ministry resource list, I have put a ton of N.T. Wright books on it. And you'll notice that many of them, there's two listings. One is the hard copy. One is the Kindle. The Kindle is what I listen to and record, but it is a whole lot easier to reference the actual paper edition because sometimes it has page numbers, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes page numbers don't actually match, and blah, 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 blah. So if you're going to reference something, it's good to have, you know, that there. So it's real simple. If y'all want me to do this, if y'all want me to roll this in, I mean, it's springtime, it's getting towards springtime. I'm looking at some big miles on the bike. I might have time to do it. To roll the N.T. Wright reading marathon into the mix. Then it's real simple. If those books disappear off the ministry resource list, that means there's people out there who want me to do it. And if they don't, then that means there ain't. And I'll move on. Yeah. So if the books stay up there and I don't get them after about a week or so, then I'll figure, okie dokie. I mean, it is Monday, and it's an unusual day to have a dividing line, so we probably have a diminished audience today because I only announced it, last night or something like that. But if the books disappear and I end up with them and the availability of doing the work, then I will do it. And otherwise, then we'll just go on from there. So that's what we'll do. So look up the ministry resource list if that's what you want to do, and we'll go from there. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, the programs that you did in 2004, I have tags, so they're all in the shopping cart, and they are tagged with either N.T. Wright or New Perspectivism.
Oh.
And they are titled properly, like, for instance, this one, Dividing Line, January 11th, 2003, New Perspectivism. And so if people want to go find what you did before, 10 years ago or so, they can do that easily.
Long time ago.
Yep.
The question is, would that back then I was the only resource I had from N.T. Wright was what St. Paul really said, and there was more than one person that I've dialogued with. In fact, where? Oh, drat! It was somebody in channel. Oh, it's Johnny. Oh, I wish I had that reference. Johnny Redeemed. No, not Johnny. Johnny Redeemed, who wrote a paper on NT Wright's perspectives, put up a blog article. And unfortunately, it's on my other Mac, and I don't have it here. He posted it in Channel. Maybe somebody has it in Channel. If it pops up, I'll try to bring it up. But he contrasted what N.T. Wright said in response specifically to Justin Brierley with a statement from what St. Paul really said from 1997. And he agreed with me that there has been at least, how would we put it? If N.T. Wright would say, I haven't changed my views, he would at least, we would hope, have to admit that he has changed his emphasis in certain things. Because Justin basically paraphrased what St. Paul really said, and N.T. Wright said, well, I would avoid that false dichotomy. But the false dichotomy is in his own book. So there seems to be much more of a friendliness toward what we might consider orthodox or orthodox reformed terminology or some emphases and things like that, at least in our conversation, than there was in 1997. So all of that said, let's get back to this Jets article or we're never going to get it done. I unfortunately didn't mark exactly where I was. And unfortunately, because I've been studying so much stuff, it's really hard for me to remember exactly where we were. But I think the important thing is to dive into, if you have the Jets article, it's page 57. I'm pretty sure I did read this paragraph. In regards to God's covenant faithfulness, how is he to be faithful to those promises? Answer, through the Messiah Jesus, who has been the one and only faithful Israelite, embodying God's covenant faithfulness. And that's why, by the way, he emphasizes that instead of rendering the genitive phrase as it's normally rendered in most Bible translations, faith in Jesus, it's the faithfulness of Jesus. In other words, it's Jesus's faithfulness that is in view, not our faith in Jesus that is in view in a number of key texts in Paul. And that you can see this here. Through the Messiah Jesus, who has been the one and only faithful Israelite, embodying God's covenant faithfulness and hence evoking through his death as an act of sheer divine grace the answering faith, which is the recognizable badge of a renewed covenant people. So, sola fide, faith alone in the Messiah is the recognizable badge of a renewed covenant people, the people who turn out to be the people God promised Abraham in the first place, fulfillment of Genesis 15, Genesis 12 and 15, the people composed equally believing Gentiles and believing Jews, because if you go back to the promise, all the way back, it could not have been limited solely to the Jews. Your seed shall be as the sand of the sea, and so on and so forth. This is the action, the sin-bearing obedience, the last Adam to the Israel vocation, as in, for instance, Isaiah 53, through which God's faithfulness of the covenant generates that forgiveness of sins because of which there can now be a sin-forgiven people. What then does it mean within the law court setting for someone to be righteous? Simply this, the court has found in their favor. It means that they have been declared to be in the right. So again, we're back to law court, but it is the Jewish law court. And don't just automatically assume, as I certainly did in the past, that we're talking about the law court that we would immediately think of from Romans chapter 8. They have not been granted, now here's where he differs, they have not been granted or imputed a righteousness which belongs to someone else. The judge's righteousness consists of his trying the case fairly in accordance with law, showing no favoritism, punishing the wrongdoer, and upholding the widow, the orphan, the defenseless. So, in this law court, the judge is righteous when he judges righteously because of what Jesus has done. There is not a transfer of righteousness to the individual. When the court finds in favor of one of the two parties at law, there is no sense in which their right righteous status carries any of these judge-specific connotations. Now, again, if we limit ourselves solely to that Hebrew concept, okay, but we can't limit ourselves to that Hebrew concept because the Bible goes beyond it. And it's Paul himself who raises the issue of God as justifier and as Jesus, as he who has died, yea, rather who was raised to life, you now have a parakletos in a judicial sense, not the Holy Spirit in this case, but you actually have an intercessor. And the issue is, and here's where I think on one hand, Wright's arguments help us to avoid. Let me use this illustration. Let me see if this helps you. I think sometimes we, and I'm referring to those of us who hold to a historic Reformed perspective, I think sometimes we get faded. We fade in our passionate holding to the fullness of God's truth. Sometimes you see this in the sense that we become imbalanced, we emphasize just one aspect of things rather than seeing the harmony of all of God's truth. For example, if you're constantly having to deal with Roman Catholics, old-style Roman Catholics, then you're going to have a massive wall between justification and sanctification because they conflate the two. Now, you'll always say, well, of course they're connected because anyone who's justified will be sanctified. You always make that. But because you sometimes are pulling one direction, you tend to lose some balance and maybe not emphasize the harmony of things so much. One of the illustrations is we have a book room at the back at Phoenix Reformed. And we buy books. We don't make any money off them. We always joke about that. We always spend more on the book room than we actually get back. But we buy books for folks because we give them away to people and things like that, and people forget to pay, and it just sort of works that way. And but there are no window coverings on the windows in the book room. Rich is laughing because he's seen this. Now, the sun actually does get to some books over one side, but for some of the books, the sun never actually hits them directly. But since there's no window coverings, and this is Arizona, it's still so bright that if the book sits there long enough, its cover will begin to fade. The colors will begin to... That's the Arizona sun, man. Let me tell you something. Yeah, especially if one part of it's covered by another book and then you move it, you can see that there has been fading over time. And I think if there's a positive thing that I can bring from my reading of N.T. Wright is that thinking through the challenges he makes forces me to revivify the colors of all of the gospel. For example, when we think of the law court in Romans 8, and when we think of imputation of righteousness, a beautiful truth that I believe in firmly, and I don't think N.T. Wright does, though he says he gets to the same conclusion but by a different path. Well, that's the big issue. That's the big question. Everybody goes, you can say that, but explain how it works, for crying out loud. Okay. He says he gets there. All right. Imputation. Beautiful truth. But taken by itself, very difficult to defend. If you take it by itself, what is the absolutely necessary element of soteriology, clear biblical teaching, that absolutely must be there to make any sense out of imputation at all? Union with Christ. Union with Christ. How can you imagine this righteous status before God, this positive righteousness, the righteousness due to the death of Christ, in other words, all the aspects of the full righteousness of Christ that is imputed to us, can you imagine that taken separately from our union with him? It doesn't make any sense. Why do we have the righteousness of Christ? Because we're united with him. We have what he has. We have the life that he has. It is that union with him that is the necessary, do I dare use the term matrix? That obviously had a different theological meaning before a certain movie came out, but it is the necessary context and surrounding matrix that holds this all together. Otherwise, you've got just these disconnected concepts that just go floating around out there, and they don't have a unified goal and direction. Obviously, I think the glorification of the triune God is the fundamental matrix of all of this. This is what God has done to glorify himself. That's why he chose to create. That's why he chose to have the fall and sin and redemption, all of that stuff. But the point is, when you read an italicized phrase like, when the court finds in favor of one of the two parties at law, there is no sense in which their righteous status carries any of these judge-specific connotations. I go beyond this, and I think Paul went beyond this. When he asks in Romans 8, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? Who are that elect? That's something else that I would love to have time to ask N.T. Wright about is, how do you understand the elect? And how do you understand these issues? And Paul's obviously talking about these things. And so how do you understand it? What's the context he places in? When Paul is talking about who is the one who condemns, God is the one who justifies. Christ Jesus is the one who died, yea, rather rose again. We're united with him. So we have gone through, we are considered to have died and have been raised to new life in union with Jesus Christ. Well, what's the nature of that new life in Jesus Christ if it does not include the perfect righteousness? And where does that perfect righteousness come from? If we have new life before the Father, if we have a positive standing as if we have fulfilled all of the law, where did it come from? It comes from our substitute. Or to use the language he used up here, up above here, let me use N.T. Wright's own language. It came from the one and only faithful Israelite, embodying God's covenant faithfulness. Well, if he embodied it, Dr. Wright, and I am united with him, then how can the righteousness that is now mine be anything other than that which he wrought in his perfect life? See? So that's why I listen to this and I go, I hear what you're saying. I just don't think you're going far enough. I don't think you're going far enough. I think you're missing the fact that, and it was very clear to me in our conversation, he does have the idea that pretty much everyone who disagrees with him, you know, we just haven't listened closely enough, and you're just doing your tradition thing, and I don't think that's the case. He goes on to say, the righteousness which they have is their right standing in the law court now that the verdict has been announced. In the same way, when God is the God who made the covenant with Abraham, declares that someone is a member of that covenant, the covenant faithfulness because of which God sends his own son to take upon him the sins of Israel and the world is not at all the same thing as the covenant membership which is demarcated by faith. The righteousness which God has in this case is simply not the same thing as the righteousness, covenant membership, of those who have faith. So he's making a distinction between God's covenant faithfulness in bringing about salvation and the announcement that someone is in the covenant. And he says we are conflating those things. All right? To think otherwise, to insist that one needs righteousness in the sense of, and I had this marked, and I don't remember now if this actually came up. I don't remember if I mentioned, I haven't actually listened to it again. Well, I started listening to it just to see how the edits turned out, but haven't taken the time to re-listen to the whole conversation. But I had this marked as one of the things I wanted to bring up. To think otherwise, to insist that one needs righteousness in the sense of moral character or repute, and that's in quotes, or whatever, comma. Now see, that bothers me, or whatever. Our concept is fairly straightforward. Nothing unclean enters into heaven. Be ye perfect, even your Father in heaven is perfect. And it's the imputation of the righteousness of Christ is not moral character or repute. It is his perfect standing, which he himself exemplified positively in his life And then, of course, provided in the sense of forgiveness in his death. It is not only the forgiveness of the positive commission of sins, but also the forgiveness of the not having accomplished and done the positive commands of God that we do not do every single day. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. We don't do that. We don't do that. So I'm concerned that, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I believe that N.T. Wright has been so often on the barbed end of the riposte that, and this is human nature. Sometimes you stop listening to what the other side is actually saying. And I've seen a number of places, here's one of them, where it just seems that there is, for someone who is so scrupulous in crossing T's and dotting I's, this is a place where he doesn't do that. Another area that he has been accused of this many, many, many times and lots of examples given is not really accurately representing what the Reformers taught. That's really not his area. Monty's just mentioned in the channel, yeah, I know where the paper is, but he, if you can find his blog, he put up a blog article yesterday, last evening as I recall, where he was contrasting the 1997 statement and something else. So if you can find his blog, then that I'd be able to read that one little thing, but I just don't have it in front of me because he gave me the link in the channel and I don't have the logs in front of me. So I go back to the statement. To think otherwise, to insist that one needs righteousness in the sense of moral character, repute, or whatever, in order to stand unashamed before God, and that lacking any of one's own, one must find some from somewhere or someone else, shows that one is still thinking in medieval categories of justitia rather than in biblical categories of law, court, and covenant. Now, justitia, of course, is a Latin term for righteousness. And what he's saying is the Reformers were very concerned about the medieval discussions of what it means to be right before God. And they were. No question about that. The question is, were those conversations unknown and irrelevant to the Apostle Paul and the early Jews? And I would say, no, they were not. Now, some of the medieval categories that the canonists had worked out and things like that, surely. But it is a pretty wild accusation to say to the Reformers that they were just asking the wrong questions, that everybody had been wrong all the way back to Augustine on this issue. Were there people who did not, in fact, recognize the role of Jewish identity and things like that in the discussions of Paul because all they were thinking about was justitia? Yes, that's true. No one's going to argue about that. Has there been a helpful correction in recognizing that Jews were not just thinking they could pull themselves up by the bootstraps? Like I said last week, I never thought that. I've always recognized the synergistic element of things. And N.T. Wright even criticized the use of the term synergistic. Well, okay. Synergistic does appear in the New Testament, and it's used positively. 2 Corinthians 6. You are synergoi. You are fellow workers with God. So it is a biblical term. But obviously that's not how I was referring to the term. I'm talking about a cooperative effort between man and God bringing about man's salvation. And more importantly, I think you can establish very clearly that this is what the Apostle Paul is speaking against in numerous texts. The concept not of people saying, I don't need any grace from God at all. I can do it all myself. I can pull myself up by my bootstraps. No. That's never been what I've been concerned about. I only know a few true Pelagians. What's that guy on YouTube? There's some dude on YouTube that preaches, open-air preaches on college campuses, and he's a full-blown Pelagian, and he says so. Don't need God's grace. You can do it on your own. I don't run into too many people like that. Not even the Mormons do that. I mean, as horribly putrid, bad New Testament theology as it is, even the Book of Mormon says, is by grace we're saved after all we can do. So there's still the necessity of grace there. Jesse Morrell, thank you. all I've got to do is wait 30 seconds and someone in channel will pop it up. No, I did not see the link. Ah, there it is. Monty came through for me. Let's see if I can get my thing over here. Bringing www.bringthebooks.org. Oh, it just scrolled. There we go. Double-click it and brought it up. Yes, okay. February 10th. Yeah, it was yesterday. Here's the section. See, now I've completely lost. I've been completely discombobulated as to where I was. Well, it happens. That's why everybody loves to listen to my program, because they like to sit there and go, well, he's just chasing another rabbit right down that hole there. It says, delightfully, Wright took issue with a comment made by Brierley. Here is the transcript of their exchange from the 2042 mark. Justin Brierley, if I can try and spell this out, and you will have to correct me, can we say that then that justification that, as far as Paul was concerned, was about membership more than personal salvation, if you like? N.T. Wright. That is precisely the either-or that we have to avoid. Justin Brierley says, okay. N.T. Wright says, because the membership question is the membership in the family of Abraham, and the purpose of Abraham's family was to undo the sin of Adam. And then Johnny says, after hearing Wright's remarks on this point, I cannot help but think back to his book, What St. Paul Really Said, because Wright makes the same point in this book that he rejects in the interview. He writes on page 119, quote, in standard Christian theological language, justification wasn't so much about soteriology as about ecclesiology, not so much about salvation as about the church. And he says, is it just me, or does this comment from Wright's book sound virtually identical to the restatement made by Brierley that Wright rejected? Yeah, that's the point. I really sense in, especially this Jets article, a shift in emphasis. How's that? A shift in emphasis. And it would be a positive shift in emphasis in that sense. But anyways, back to the idea of justitia. It seems to me very clear that the central core heart issues in regards to justitia are in Paul and will be in every age as long as there are men who contemplate their relationship to God rather than just their relationship to the nation of Israel. And this is why I tried to bring in, I just didn't have time to do it, but I tried to bring in, what do I say to my Muslim friends? Because this is, you know, if you want to get rid of medieval categories, okay, let's talk to my Muslim friends. How do they stand before God? How do they stand before God? Any of you who have seen me speak on Islam, you know that I almost always, not always, but I almost always finish with a video or a picture from the attack on the Glasgow airport, where two men drove a Jeep Cherokee into the door and tried to explode it. It exploded. It only killed them, but it didn't kill anybody else, thankfully. And I tell them, you know, these guys were not down and outers. They were national health care physicians. They were physicians. They're doctors. And why do I show that? Because theology matters. The system of belief that they embraced gave them a holy God, God's righteous law, and the fact that they're sinners, but has denied to them a mediator. And what's that all about? Justitia. How many Muslims in the world know the term justitia? Almost none. Almost none at all. But it's justitia that drove that Jeep into a door. It's the issue of the righteousness of God that is the key here. That's what's so vital. And so what I'm saying is, our understanding of what Paul is saying transcends the original context in which the things he was saying had meaning. In other words, the gospel goes beyond just its original setting. You've got to understand it there. That's why some of these correctives are helpful in making sure that we remain balanced. But you can't just freeze it there and say that's all it's relevant to. The gospel is meant to go out to the whole world. And it's meant to... Similar example. This is one of the things that, you know, if if I end up reading these other books, one of the things I'm going to be really, 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 really looking at is the issue of his Christology. And because there's an area where if you want to talk Trinity, if you want to talk deity of Christ, then clearly you have the necessity to look at the biblical text and to allow it to speak with a transcendent voice, which it almost seems sometimes Tom Wright is not allowing it to do when it comes to justification and soteriology as a whole. And that's a problem. So looking at the missed resource list, we've got four of them down. So we got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Is that what I've got? I think there's 10 more there. Does it go on to the next? Where's the next page? Page 107? There's not 7 pages there. That's ridiculous. No, it's page 101. There's only 10 items left there. How could there only be 10 items left there? Anyways, I'll check that later. But some have been picked up. Very, very appreciated. I saw someone in channel mention that. Much appreciated. All right. I'm not going to get this done if I do not speed up. And in fact, at quarter till, I'm not going to. I have thus, by drawing in the covenant, anticipated the next point. The law court in question is the covenantal one in which God's promises to Abraham are at stake. The right standing of those in whose favor the court has found is at the same time the covenantal status they enjoy as members of Abraham's true family, which includes among his privileges, as I have insisted, the assurance of sins forgiven and of the promise that those whom God justified, them he also glorified. Now, that's Romans 8. Sounds to me, that's the elect there. So are we talking new covenant here? And can we bring in Hebrews and the new covenant and everything new covenant involves, including union and righteousness and the heart and all the rest of that stuff and regeneration and all those things that are part and parcel of our understanding? Is that, can we do that? The law court setting, in other words, is not just one illustration among others. It is the theologically apt and appropriate metaphor through which we see what is happening to God's covenant promises. Well, if that's the case, if it is the overriding, just as the exile narrative becomes the overriding narrative in N.T. Wright's theology, if that's the case, can't we allow Paul to expand it to its new covenant fulfillment in Romans 8? With the intercessor in union with Christ and all the things that go with it? It seems to me to flatten out the fulfillment language in the New Testament to emphasize the Old Testament narratives and paradigms to the point where they don't allow the fulfillment to be greater than the initial categories of the promise. I've seen that in regards to prophetic stuff, in regards to Messiah and things like that as well. Not with Wright, but with others. The covenant was established in the first place in order to set the world right. This is how the language works, and it works without equivocation in passage after passage throughout Paul. That, for a biblically faithful Christian, is what counts. We are, and again, we're not used to having this thrown our direction. I think it causes us discomfort. We are not at liberty to pick and choose in God's word. We are bound to search it all, to study it all, to make sure we interpret each element in the light of the whole, and the whole in the light of each element. I couldn't have said it better myself. What's the terminology I've used for that for years? Tota Scriptura and Sola Scriptura. I like the way it's said. Question is, who's doing it? I have written about the relevant passages at length, of course, in various places. A fairly complete list may be found in the bibliography of my work, Justification, God's Plan, and Paul's Vision, 2009. I have drawn attention repeatedly, for instance, to the single letter E in Romans 3:29. In Romans 3:29, which indicates that for Paul, though not for the current old perspective proponents, there is a close and unbreakable link between between justification by faith and the inclusion of Gentiles within God's people. Now, I don't think that's fair. I do not think that it is fair to say that for someone such as myself, and I do not really want the terminology old perspectivist, for historically Reformed interpreters of the text, that the idea of justification by faith and the inclusion of Gentiles in God's people are two completely separate things. I don't know how many times, even when I lecture on Islam, and again, those of you who've watched, those of you who've seen me do this, know this is the case. I will show a clip of people becoming Muslims. It's from down in Sydney. It's Khalid Yasin leading people and saying the Shahada. And then I ask people, you just watched people become Muslims. What was troubling about that to you? What were things that were similar and different? And one of the things I ask is, what the men that were passing out the gifts to people, what were they wearing? They were wearing the same clothes that Muhammad would have worn at the beginning of the 7th century in Arabia. And I ask people, how many of you made your profession of faith in Jesus Christ in either biblical Greek or biblical Hebrew? And no one's ever said they did. And yet, to make your profession of faith in Islam, La ilaha illallah wa Muhammadan Rasulallah, you have to say it in Arabic. Even if you don't know what you're saying. And so, what I do is I say, we avoided this in Acts 15. The reason Christianity doesn't have these elements is because we avoided this in Acts 15. Paul saw in Galatians 2 the danger of having a Jewish Christian church and a Gentile Christian church. And you can go back. I'm pretty certain that the lectures I gave on Galatians 1 back at D.L. Culver's house back in the 1990s somewhere. I think we have that Galatians 1 6-9, that anathema one. I think that's in the bookstore somewhere. I think it was. And what you're going to hear me, long before I'd ever heard of N.T. Wright, is talking about the fact that there is a danger that the Apostle Paul sees that Peter does not, of that division, to where you have justification by faith being the curative to the idea of a divided church. So, I'm sorry, maybe he has talked with many people where they don't see the link between justification by faith and the inclusion of Gentiles in God's people. I always have. That's why I so often sort of cock my head and go, eh? When I'm reading N.T. Wright's criticisms of quote-unquote old perspectivists, because allegedly that's me. I'm a geocentrist from his perspective, but that's not where I was coming from. That's not how I've understood it. I've drawn attention to the difference between Paul's phrase, a righteousness from God, the kaiosune ektheou, and one nice thing about Tom Wright and myself, we can exchange Greek and understand each other. He uses the same pronunciation system I do. He doesn't use that stupid modern Greek stuff. Alan Kirshner's gotten into using that modern Greek silliness rather than the tried and true ways of Erasmian pronunciation. And both N.T. Wright and I use Erasmian pronunciation and what?
Oh, now wait, do I hear tradition?
Yes, you do. It's the only way you can pronounce it and differentiate words, that's why. Anyways, that did come up during the course of the conversation. I've drawn attention to the difference between Paul's phrase, a righteousness from God, the kaiosune ektheou, in Philippians 3:9, referring to the righteous status of the covenant member, and the more usual dikaiosune ektheou, the righteousness of God himself, in Romans 1:17, 3:21-26, 10:3. And I've shown how these precise verbal distinctions are an exact index of exactly what Paul wants to say. Well, we'd have to go through each one of those to discuss exactly what he's saying about that. But I had marked what came after this. Once again, it is strange and even amusing to find people whose main claim is that they are faithful to scriptures ready to twist and bend Paul's actual and specific language to fit the traditional schemes with which they start, especially when the precise meaning of the words offers an excellent and coherent sense. Now, whatever else you say, you've got to understand that from N.T. Wright's perspective. Disagree with him, if you will. Be prepared to explain why. Disagree with him, if you will. But from his perspective, he is actually defending sola scriptura and a biblicist position. He has to, because on some of these interpretations, his interpretation is a theological novum. And by the way, as we're obviously going to have to continue this in the future, as well as getting back to other issues that we need to address. I did want to respond to something that did come up in the program and that also comes up in his comments on this. But when he basically says, look, the reformers would have agreed with me that it's okay to be out on a limb with an interpretation. They would have agreed with me over against you traditionalists. But the fact of the matter is, the reformers, while they were more than happy to disagree with Rome's abuse of Scripture, did not believe that they were coming up with an interpretation of Scripture that no one else had ever seen. It is the constant refrain of the reformers to go back to the early church to find individuals who may have been a minority voice, but they were there, that agreed with them in their reading of the text of Scripture. The idea that they would have defended the concept that, well, okay, well, for example, there's one place, I believe it might be Romans 10:4, I'd have to look at it, I had it in my notes on Thursday, where in the list of unique interpretations and readings from N.T. Wright, he actually takes one where he suggests a conjectural emendation. A conjectural emendation is a change of the text where you have no textual evidence to substantiate. So you're going to change the Greek text and say it actually read this, but there are no manuscripts to support that. So there's one place where he even suggests that. The reformers did not come along and say, we're just coming up with all sorts of new stuff, and we don't care what anybody believed before us. That's not what they were saying. Their biblicism was not a biblicism that, in essence, said, we are the first generation to have ever read the Bible. Their biblicism made it the primary source of authority, the norma normata, but it did not present the idea that no one before me has ever thought of the things that I am now thinking of. That just simply isn't how it happened. According to my clock, you're early. Really? Well, according to my clock, you're about 15 seconds early. Now, and who knows what I could have said in that 15 seconds. It may have been the thing that allowed people to understand what N.T. Wright was saying. Who knows? Oh, just finish up? Okay, all right. All right, folks, heading to Charlotte on Wednesday, Thursday night, debate with Michael Brown. Saturday, debate with Shadeed Lewis, presenting papers, RTS, SES. See y'all there. We'll see you next week. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.